So farming the city is important for me and for my work, which is about enabling people to have access to good, healthy, affordable, and culturally acceptable food. And that's a basic human right.
You're listening to Climate Curious, a podcast for people who care about the world but find the current conversation about climate change confusing, boring, or scary.
My name is Mariam Pasha, and I'm the director and curator at TEDx London and co-host of this podcast, along with the amazing Ben Hurst. Say hello, Ben.
Hey there, friends. I'm Ben Hurst, activist and advocate exploring what positive masculinities can look like, humble model, and climate normie.
Hello, Ben.
Hello. Hello, Mariam.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Climate Curious podcast. Are you excited?
Yeah, I'm so excited. This is going to be such a good episode.
And listeners, if you're wondering why we're so excited, because finally Ben and I get to talk about something we really love. What are we going to talk about this week?
The joy of food. Yes.
I love food. My dad used to say that as a kid, like, my face would just light up every time there was food around. Still hasn't changed.
Oh, that's so cute. It's cute. I was one of those picky kids. I didn't eat my dinner. Like, I used to try and, like, wrap peas up in toilet roll and flush them down the toilet. And it never, ever worked. But my appreciation of food has grown as I have grown as a person.
You're not still hiding peas. That's good.
I eat them now.
But obviously, talking about food and climate change is, well, it's kind of a downer, actually. So I've been looking into this, and apparently our global food system contributes to between like 21 and like 37% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And those are like the emissions that are warming our planet, that are creating that blanket around the planet and warming it and contributing to climate change.
That doesn't sound good.
That's a lot. Right. So this is something that I guess you can't really tackle climate change without looking at this, which is why we're so excited. So Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about who we're speaking to today?
Okay, I'm so excited to introduce this guest, but you know that sometimes when guests have done too many things, it's really hard to introduce them, because how do you pick? We've spent like 10 minutes editing this introduction down just so that it will fit. So I would love to introduce you to Dee Woods. Dee is the co-founder of Granville Community Kitchen in South Kilburn in London. She is also a member of the Food Ethics Council and an advisor to the Farm in the Future Fund. She's spoken around the world on food policy, on food insecurity and food justice issues. And Dee's work advocates for good food for all, people's right to food and nutrition, and the intersection of climate change and social justice. So join us in an imaginary welcoming round of applause, Dee Woods. Welcome, Dee, to the Climate Curious podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. I want to start off in a very specific way, because I think when we think about climate change and when I think about food, this feels like, out of all of the conversations to do with climate change, this feels like one of the biggest ones. It feels like one of the ones that I feel personally maybe the most powerless in. I think one of the reasons for that is because the conversation always seems to turn into a conversation about veganism. I'm black, so I don't know. That just feels like a conversation that's not really for me. And I don't know if that's where we're going today. I don't have any clue, like, whether is that what we're talking about? So when I know you do a lot of work around food and its links to climate change, does that mean that you are a vegan? Does that mean that you are telling me that I should be a vegan? Is that what we're doing?
Not at all. And I have been on vegan platforms discussing this, but you're right, it is the go-to solution for most people, right. Including a lot of black vegans, thinking that if we stop eating meat and eat more vegetables and what they call arable crops, so wheat and pulses, that we will save the planet. And it's just wrong. It's just a false solution. But our predominant model of agriculture is sort of intensive industrial agriculture, which doesn't feed anyone. It uses most lands, so sort of 75% of our land, but only produces 25% of our food. So that's why it's a false solution, because what we'll be doing is using more land to do more monocropping, and we won't be feeding everyone. And there are places in the world where you just cannot grow food and vegetables. You have to farm animals. So
I didn't know that that was a thing. Maren, did you know that that was a thing, that there are places in the world where you can't grow?
I mean, yeah, but I always think of them as like the extremes, you know, like the deserts or the kind of places that flood often, or whatever it might be. But, you know, one of the things I think we're starting to see with, you know, increasing temperatures is that more and more places on Earth become, you know, land we can't use. And Dee, I wanted to ask you a question about this, because I think, you know, this is a really interesting shift in the conversation, because I think sometimes what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, if people want to be vegan, that's a personal choice, and that can have positive impacts if they want. But that if they're doing it just as like a silver bullet to climate change, that it is not that. That actually what we're looking for here are answers to the bigger problems of the food industry that contribute to climate change. Have I got that right?
You've got that right.
So for us, like city dwellers, I was going to say Londoners, but not obviously not everybody that's going to listen to this is from London. But for those of us who live in cities and built up places and spaces, how does this, I think this is the bit where I become a little bit confused, is how does the food that we're eating here link to climate change in other spaces? And I don't know if you, like, if you want to share maybe some of your perspective on like that link between climate change and food and how those two things go together.
Okay. I think we need to go back a bit to understand our sort of global food system, which Britain is the architect of. So we've gone out for several hundred years and extracted and exploited elsewhere and always brought food back. And that has set in motion sort of the conditions for climate change. So when you eradicate forests and destroy that biodiversity, destroy sort of, you're causing deserts, you're causing flooding, and when the weather changes, there's nothing to in the way to prevent all this damage. And that's been a repeated thing over several hundred years. And a lot of our food still comes from elsewhere. So even though enslavement ended, we're still exploiting food, people and countries and places, and extracting to get quite a lot of our food. I mean, we're only probably about 50% food secure.
So where does your background in food come from? Because I often think one of the things that I find really interesting to speak to people, like to our guests about, is like why they care about this as an issue for you.
For me, it came from my childhood and moving from the UK to the Caribbean. My dad's a farmer, and one of the first things he did when we got there, you know, as children, was take us on a tour of Trinidad and taste every possible fruit, herb, you name it, and showed us how it grew. And I think probably for him, it was passing on a legacy and not knowing which one of us would take it up. And I never thought I would be into into farming. I've always been a good cook and baker, even as a child. I still have my first cookbook from when I was sort of six. Cooking has always been that thing for me and having really good fresh ingredients. But for me, it wasn't until later on when I became ill and started looking into sort of food and healing and health and nutrition that I sort of realized that, yeah, food is so much more in terms of culture and history and legacy and everything, really.
And it's so interesting. Like, you spoke about healing, right? And I think that aspect of food is one that kind of reconnects us with the planet. This kind of understanding that we're all part of the same, like, ecology or system that keeps things alive. And I think, like, maybe as humans, we sometimes start to think of ourselves as though we just live here and this, and we're not part of it. So that's really, like, super, super interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think that really is a Western perception that we have environment and that we're not part of it, whereas for all other sort of indigenous communities, including African peoples, we have that connection where we are part of nature. So I always say that the earth is my mother.
When I think about food and I think about climate change, and I think about the things that I hear, you know, like we're overfishing or there are extreme weather events that are making it like ruining crop cycles, or like we said before, there are parts of the world where you can't grow land. All of that just seems super, super removed and distant to me. You know, I don't see the connection between those things that I'm contributing to as a human on the planet and the food that I might buy in the supermarket. And I'm just curious to know whether you feel like that distance is part of what is perpetuating this kind of system.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think one of the things with this pandemic and people not being able to access food or things missing from supermarket shelves, and then quickly followed by Brexit, people became more sort of open to understanding where their food came from.
Right.
So there was this big sort of U-turn of people wanting good, organic, fresh food, or wanting to grow their own food. And that's one of the best things we can do, because we're greening our neighbourhoods. People are taking up lawns and concrete to grow food, and to have that food as close as possible to them. And that's brilliant.
And it is really interesting, isn't it? Like, I do think the pandemic has definitely brought that around for people, like this almost feeling of like urgency, like, oh, like one day this could all just stop. And then how do I get food? Like if I don't know how to grow food, if I don't know where to get food from, and suddenly like everything just crashes like it did, then how do I get the things that I need to get? And maybe that's one of the ways that this kind of conversation becomes more relevant to people who do live in cities, right? I'm like really interested in the work that you're doing around farming, because farming to me seems like a really I don't know the right way to say what I'm thinking, but like almost like an outdated concept. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like in my mind, the future of farming is like robots and pesticides rather like no one's ever going to be like working in a field or farming. And I don't even know if that's like what you do. Are you like the person with your hands in the mud, like literally farming the actual vegetables, or like how does that work?
So I'm one of those people who has that connection with soil and insects and observing cycles and waiting for the rain. Because if our soil dies, if our biodiversity dies, we die. And I think being in a city surrounded by this concrete and steel and glass isn't good for us as human beings. So farming the city is important, you know, for me and for my work, which is about enabling people to have access to good, healthy, affordable, and culturally acceptable food. And that's a basic human right as well.
Right. Yeah. What I'm understanding, the picture that I'm getting so far is that over farming is a problem in terms of climate change. So then what do we do? Does it mean that everybody needs to farm in their gardens, or does it what does this look like practically?
I think with large cities like ours, I think it's virtually impossible for everyone to grow their own food. Not everyone wants to, not everyone has those skills. But we do need to be producing more food in the UK and in as many spaces as possible. So in New York, for instance, they're sort of large roof gardens and aquaponic, farms producing food. In Paris, it's the same thing. Virtually every roof is a green roof. That has sort of implications for climate in terms of heat reduction and biodiversity. It's not just about planting a tree or just growing a few things in your windowsill. We literally need to be producing much, much more food.
So I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about Granville Community Kitchen, because one of the things that you said is that, maybe not everyone wants to be farming or growing, and maybe it's not just about those small things, but larger solutions. And I feel like you're really part of that solution here. And I'd love for you to just tell people who aren't familiar with what you do there and the boxes and how that works. And I guess also how that contributes to some of the equity work that you're doing.
Little background, Granville Community Kitchen sort of emerged as a community-led response to sort of household food insecurity that we were observing, but also myself experiencing that and not wanting to go to a food bank and wanting to sort of use my own knowledge as well as sort of working with other people to use their knowledge to produce something that would truly meet our needs in that South Kilburn neighbourhood and also for it to be dignified. So I started cooking meals. We have education things around food growing, composting, saving seed, and general activities around well-being. And throughout that is always about how do we build equity into our food system, into this little area, into this little sort of local food economy. And that's what we've been actively doing. So we have what we call a patchwork farm. So we grow on little bits of land wherever we can find land. And we're producing stuff that we can grow intensely, or what we call high value products. So things like herbs, salad leaves, green vegetables. We also have fruits and nuts. And then sort of last year, we really saw need with sort of the high levels of food insecurity because of the pandemic and the emergency, that we really needed to have a solution. And we started what we call a solidarity veg box scheme, where it's a tiered price. Those who can't afford, for whatever reason, to pay a full price, they pay sort of a lower price, and those who can pay more subsidize that. And that's expanding into a food cooperative and markets. But the key difference to a lot of other veg box schemes is that we provide culturally acceptable foods, and part of that means trading directly with people in the global south, because we can't produce everything here. We can't grow yams. I want to try and grow what they call upland rice, Other people haven't been successful. So there are foods we really can't produce here. And so we do need to import them. But we need to import them with the same values of equity. So we're working with an organization who work directly with small farmers in West Africa, and we're extending that now to the Caribbean, and there will be other places as well.
You know what I love about this, and the reason I wanted you to talk about it, is because a lot of times I'm in conversations, or we have in conversations, where we're like, oh, you know, we need to find these intersectional approaches between climate change and climate justice and equity and all of these kinds of big terms. And it's just so abstract, right? And it doesn't really mean anything, because I can't picture what that solution is. And when I look at the work you do and you talk about it, I feel like that's what an intersectional approach looks like and feels like. And I absolutely love that you use the word dignity, because there's something about, like, that is, you know, that's nothing to do with, like, your carbon footprint, but yet it's so essential to the way that we, I think, the kind of society we want to create, you know, and be part of.
And it is about localized solutions. It is about having everyone at the table and having an input into designing those solutions. So everything we've done at Granville Community has come from the community. And things we know we can't deliver, then we feed that back. And I agree with you that all the language around those things, they're highly academic. A lot of them are policy speakers as well. And I think in a lot of ways, that's why I'm unique in this work, because I'm a knowledge broker, as someone described me. I'm able to sort of translate all that and bring it back to the grassroots, and likewise bring stuff from the grassroots right back up to policy spaces.
Is that something that you spend a lot of time doing, like that policy piece? And is that like a really important also piece of this conversation?
I do spend quite a lot of time doing that. I'm doing it right now with our national food strategy, with sort of the international sort of stage, and with the current UN Food Systems Summit, because people sit down in these places and make decisions that impact people's lives. So if we're not in those spaces, then things happen. So someone made a decision to allow all these chicken shops in sort of low income areas. And my wonderful colleague, Tim Lang, he came up with the term food deserts, but they're not food deserts. Deserts are natural or can be sort of man-made phenomena. It's food apartheid, as Karen Washington in the US says. Someone made a deliberate decision. So in South Kilburn, in fact, that we don't have any more local shops, except what? Marks and Spencer's and one other sort of supermarket thing that doesn't sell good food. That was a decision someone made.
Yeah, and do you know what I find interesting about that point is my understanding, again, of the food, like the food issue in and of itself, was that there was a lot of blame attached to poorer people, in inverted commas, almost as if to say, like, these people are choosing to eat badly, or they're choosing, they don't want to eat well, like they want to give their kids bad food from Iceland or whatever. And I never really understood why that was wrong. There was just something that felt very wrong about it. And actually, I wonder if that, like you're saying, is to do with like a food apartheid, and more to do with decisions that are, that's the first time that I've made that link, actually. That, thank you so much for sharing that, because it seems like that's maybe why that work on that policy level becomes more important. And it's almost as though, like, I hate when people say stuff like, you're a voice for the voiceless and all of that kind of stuff, because everybody's got a voice. Some people are just silent. But it does seem like we need more people in that space who are able to speak from for those communities who are not given that space to speak.
Oh, we definitely need more voices. We definitely need younger people to take that up. This is part of activism. We can't all be on the front line. We need to be working, you know, at different levels. And one thing I've always done, I've always tried to bring people with me. So if I went to a parliamentary event, believe me, I'm bringing a couple of people with me.
Right.
I've been to like a food sovereignty gathering and took someone from the community. And that sort of fueled her activism around food and environment. We need to be in the policy spaces, and especially as racialized and minoritized people.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough voices.
I'm wondering now, we're coming to the end of this conversation, and I feel like we've touched on so many different things, which is super important because it's such a big conversation. But if there was something that listeners could take away from this conversation, or like an action that they could do or practice or something, what would that be that you would share with people?
Sign the petition on the human right to food, mm-hmm. so that we can get a debate in Parliament. So if you go to MP Ian Burns page, there is a petition, and the human right to food is important in ensuring that people are able to access food. Our government has a responsibility to us to ensure food security.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. And two, I would say become a food citizen. And the Food Ethics Council, of which I'm a member, we have a Food Citizen Manifesto. So if you go to the website, it will tell you what a food citizen is. And it is about just being more than a consumer. It is about thinking about all these things before you make a decision. It is going beyond sort of individuality and thinking holistically, that your decision, that your shopping decision has so much impact that reverberates right around the world.
Right. So become a food citizen one, sign the human rights to food petition, which we will leave a link to in the bio of this conversation, and buy your vegetable boxes.
Yes, and please support. Yes, if you live in the Maidervale, Queen's Park, sort of Kilburn area, Camden, please support our good food box scheme.
I'm doing it this week.
So, yeah.
I wonder who else is joining me. Dee, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you, to explore, massive. You know, almost feel like go around the world and talk about all of these things, and to take the conversation about food and climate change to, like, for me, to hold all different places that I don't often get to talk about. So I really want to thank you about that. You know, we've got one last thing to do in this episode. So then I'm going to hand that to you to introduce it.
It's time for Climate Confession.
And now it's time for our climate confessions. Let's fess up to the bad habits we just can't kick.
This is the part of the show where our guests get to share some of their own climate confessions. It's just to give our listeners some hope that they can still be normal human beings and make mistakes and have stuff that they're still working on in real time. So, Dee, we're super interested. I am so interested because I feel like there is nothing, but super interested to know what your climate confession is for this week.
Mine is fizzy water.
Ooh.
And I drink that all the time, and it involves plastic bottles.
Mm-hmm.
I try to buy them in glass, and I have bought one of those machines to make it at home, but I think I need to be digging deeper. Maybe I need to be looking at sort of one of my ancestral foods and getting into drinking a fermented sort of drink.
Mm.
Yeah. If I really want that fizz.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel like that was a really hard confession. We are really appreciative that you've shared that with you. That's like a deep-seated love you have for carbonated water. I love it. I've got one from, so we've been crowdsourcing some confessions from our team and from our listeners, because I think Ben and I just cannot keep revealing so much about ourselves emotionally.
Deal with the stress.
And I have a doozy for us this week.
Ooh.
So this one belongs to Rebecca Mingus, who's on the TEDx London team. I do have her permission to share it and her permission to use her name, because I had to ask that, because after she told me what it was, I was like,
is it really
are you
bad?
Sure that you want to be associated
with
this?
You want people to know about this.
So Rebecca, as many of us have during this pandemic, has gotten into having lots of houseplants.
Mm-hmm.
She gets very afraid. She's very attached to these houseplants. She gets very afraid that they might get cold during the day. And so in the winter months, she leaves all the heating on in her house all day while she's out at work to make sure that her houseplants are nice and toasty and live in essentially a greenhouse.
And I
followed up with her and I said, do you have gas central heating? Hoping that maybe she didn't, but yes, she does also have gas central heating. So this is a double whammy. And I would actually be really curious to know that maybe a lot of us leave our heatings and things on. I've been known sometimes accidentally to open a window when the heating's on because I forget. So I'm, you know, energy efficiency is a big one for climate. So I just want to say thank you for Rebecca.
That was super honest. Did you hear me gasp in judgment? I was like, oh no, that's terrible. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being so honest and vulnerable with us and allowing us to share that. And Dee, thank you so, so, so much. I feel like you have expanded my mind tenfold. And there's so much, this has been an amazing conversation. There's so much to consider about food and its links to climate change that I had never thought about before. And so thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Stay curious.
Oh, stay curious. And remember, stay curious. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We really hope you enjoyed this episode.
If you did, please rate, subscribe, and share this episode with a curious friend. It makes us possible to keep making this amazing content for you.
Oh, and slide into our DMs at TEDx London and let us know which climate extraordinaires you'd love to hear from next time. Oh, and don't leave yet. We wanted to tell you a bit more about who made this podcast possible.
Yeah, we did. TEDx London's headline partner, City, has been supporting us for the past 5 years to bring world-changing ideas to the TEDx London stage. And now they're taking it to the next level by making this podcast possible. Thanks, City.
But wait, that is not all.
No, this podcast was produced by the amazing Josie Coulter.
Curation and research by the genius Tara Cooper.
Artwork designed by the visionaries that are Sabrina Russo and Rebecca Mingus.
Mixed and engineered by the iconic Ben Beheshti, aka The Falcon, who also composed our banging theme tune.
Presented by me, Marion Pasha.
And by me, Ben Hurst. Stay curious.
Yeah, can I have loads of plants indoors that I overwinter, and you know, I try not to have the heating on. And then my boiler went last winter. So literally, I had to keep sort of all my chilies going, probably about 25. So there's fleece.
Like a fleece jacket, like a blanket?
No, there's what I call horticultural fleece.
Oh, okay. Not like my fleece blanket.
No. All right, so they'll still get light, but it will keep them warm.
Yes.
Or the Victorian favourite, which is horseshit.
Yeah, maybe not that one.